Hello and welcome to the CISS podcast. This is the Point series by China Forum. In this series, we will have one-on-one discussions with top-level officials, diplomats, well-known entrepreneurs, academics, and media experts from both China and abroad to hear their fresh insights on important global issues.
Hello and welcome to the CISS podcast, the Point series. I'm Dawei with China Forum, CISS Tsinghua University. With the intensification of geopolitical games among major powers, nuclear issue has become increasingly prominent. Emerging technologies like AI and quantum computing are reshaping the foundations of international security. Our program today will focus on nuclear issue in China-US relations. Our guest speaker today is Dr. Fiona Cunningham, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. Please stay tuned. Great, Fiona. It's really our great pleasure to have you here. So I know that you have spent 2 weeks.
Two weeks
in China already. How's your visit so far?
Well, thank you, first of all, for having me on the podcast and having me at CISS. It has been a wonderful trip for the last 2 weeks that I've spent here in China. It's just after the Spring Festival concluded, yeah. So everyone I've met with here is full of energy for the new year as well and seems very happy and relaxed. And so it's actually a really lovely time to visit China because there's still lanterns up all around Beijing and yes. There's that kind of glow from the vacation. Oh.
Yeah, really nice to know that. Did you go to some other cities outside Beijing?
Unfortunately, this time I haven't had the chance to get outside of Beijing because I had a full agenda of meetings and events to do here in Beijing, but hopefully next time.
Okay, great. Really glad to know that you had a very fruitful and smooth visit to Beijing, and we are very happy to host you here. So let's move on to today's topic. So you are an expert on nuclear issue, strategic stability issue. So today we'll have this very serious discussion on this very serious topics. Yeah, so I know that you published a new book last year entitled Under the Nuclear Shadow, China's Information Age Weapon in International Security. So basically in the book, I think you explored China's post-Cold War deterrence strategy and also proposed an idea called strategic substitution. So can you elaborate a little bit on what's your argument in that book and also say something about this very original idea, the theory of the strategic substitution?
Great. Well, it's very exciting to finally have this book out because it was based on a lot of research that I had done previously here in China on prior visits. So
it's not on your PhD dissertation.
It is. Yes. Oh, it is. Yes. Yeah, it takes, as some of your listeners might know, a long time to turn a dissertation into a book, especially in a rapidly changing world. But what I was seeking to achieve or to answer with this book is to tackle what I think is a puzzle for some scholars of strategic deterrence and nuclear issues, which is every country wants to solve or address this dilemma that happened in the nuclear age, that you still want to use your military capabilities for leverage to achieve your political aims, but you also don't want to fight a catastrophic nuclear war that everyone is going to lose. And most countries solve this problem one of two ways. They either developed very formidable conventional military capabilities, so the US in the post-Cold War era is the ideal type there, or they threaten to use nuclear weapons first, of which you might say Pakistan or Russia is a good example of this. China didn't do either of these two things. And so it led to, I think, a lot of scholars to say, well, you know, maybe China has some secret, you know, nuclear first use policy or something like that.
Yeah.
And what I do in the book is to make an argument that that is not the case, but rather that China has developed, I'd say, a distinctive way of addressing this problem, which is to really rely on some of the technologies of the information age, cyber capabilities used offensively, counter space capabilities, and conventional precision strike missiles as a way of getting leverage, but without needing to go that step of threatening to use nuclear weapons. So in addition, there's a kind of theoretical structure where I look at this idea of strategic substitution. Basically, what strategic substitution means is that you're relying upon non-nuclear weapons as a way of gaining leverage against your adversaries rather than threatening to use nuclear weapons. And very importantly, is pairing it with the kind of retaliatory nuclear strategy. China's no first use policy is a key kind of example of that, where you're not threatening to use nuclear weapons first, but you're using some of these other technologies as a way of pursuing your interests. And I make an argument that the reason why countries tend to pursue substitution is because something happens in their relationship that makes them feel like they have a deficit in the amount of leverage. And what does that mean? It means that basically they look at the conflicts they have to prepare for, they look at the adversaries that they are likely to be facing, and they feel like they don't have the military capabilities to counter that adversary, and so they'll have to make either humiliating concessions or fight a war that they're going to lose if they don't do something. And what they do then is to pursue additional leverage, and the reason that they end up going towards these non-nuclear information age weapons is because it's much more credible to threaten to use them than the very high cost issue of using nuclear weapons first. But it's also much faster than trying to build up your conventional military capabilities and have that, you know, effect that might take generations to kind of close that gap. And so that's kind of the key argument in the book, is looking at how more quickly and credibly you can rely on technology to kind of fill these gaps that otherwise might exist in your military strategy and capability. So that's the idea behind
that. I see. So then as China is modernizing its military capability, including its nuclear capability and also building up its nuclear arsenal, do you think China still stick to this strategic substitution theory or strategy, or China is also changing its strategy, behave more like the existing nuclear power like the US and other countries?
So I think the conclusion I come down on, and obviously this is an issue that I'm continuing to kind of watch and research and try to understand, and books are usually finished long before they're published. But my conclusion is that China has built up now its conventional military capabilities very significantly. Mm-hmm. It hasn't, I think, gained superiority over its adversaries, especially the United States, in ways that would mean it could rely solely on its conventional capabilities to sort of gain leverage. It also is building up its nuclear capabilities. So it now has options that it didn't have back in the early 2000s or late 1990s.
So at that time, I mean, China have to rely on that new technology.
Strategic substitution, I think, for China was born of very significant constraints and the options it had to go for these two traditional options. Mm-hmm. And it now has those options. Mm-hmm. So the question then becomes, how does China think about the advantages of strategic substitution versus the nuclear or the conventional options? And none of these are a silver bullet. The traditional options are not a silver bullet. They come with also some very significant drawbacks. So my sense is that China now has better options. So far, I see insufficient evidence that China is changing its nuclear strategy in a way that is trying
to... At least
it
has not abandoned the old
It has
one.
Not. Yeah. No, no, no. Yeah. And I think despite the fact that China has been building up its nuclear capabilities, it has diplomatically really strongly reinforced its nuclear no first use policy and insisted that this is for retaliatory purposes and about the adequacy of its deterrence. So I don't see the clear evidence that China has shifted and said, I'm going to be more like Russia or Pakistan in how I solve or address this dilemma. But again, the other thing that's worth noting is that now China and many other countries have a lot more experience looking at whether or not these information age weapons can live up to the promise of giving you the leverage that you seek. I mean, we can look at Ukraine. It really doesn't look like Russia's cyber attacks on Ukrainian critical infrastructure delivered on their promise to have a strategic effect on Ukrainian decision makers. So things like that can lead to pause for a country like China that might think of these information age weapons as having this very significant role because they're seeing now in conflict, they're seeing from their own experience that maybe they're not the ideal capabilities. So I think My conclusion is that it remains to be seen what comes next, but I will watch this space, and hopefully if something changes, or even if it doesn't, I will try and write an article to sort of give the sequel, if you like, to the book.
Yeah, okay, that's very helpful. And also, I think very important argument. As a Chinese researcher, I think I learned from you what you argued. I think it's good. I think from our perspective, it's good that we can have more options at least.
Mm-hmm.
And I think China is also still thinking, debating internally, I mean domestically, about our nuclear strategy.
Yep.
Yeah, I think this is some ongoing debate in China.
Yeah, that's my impression as well.
Yeah. So currently, with the rapid development of the new technology like AI, like biotechnology and other technologies, many people worry that it will lower the cost of a military, particularly a nuclear conflict. Do you think these technologies could change the nuclear taboo that we said during the Cold War that has been placed since that time and possibly leading to a kind of great power conflict, particularly with nuclear weapons?
So I think it really depends upon how countries use the emerging technology. To take like the frameworks that I think you see in a lot of the political science literature in the world that I inhabit as a scholar, most scholars will conclude that technology is really, really, really important. But except for nuclear weapons, most of the time what matters is how you use the technology. Of course, the technology itself is going to have constraints on how you can use it, but how countries decide to integrate their new technologies into their military strategies, I think will have a profound effect on just how these new technologies are going to affect the nuclear taboo. And so I'll give you an example of how that is the case. On the one hand, if you look at something like strategic substitution, that is a way of using some emerging or disruptive technologies to keep the nuclear threshold really high, because suddenly you have other options that put less pressure on you to think about using nuclear weapons first, because you have other options at kind of lower levels of the conflict spectrum that mean you can keep that threshold very high. On the other hand, these technologies are often going to be shared, if you like, with things that help a country operate its nuclear weapons. Of course, you know, you have a warhead that is the nuclear piece of the equation, but it has to be delivered by something, which is usually a missile. And one of the emerging disruptive technologies is, many decades ago, was the conventional precision strike, the idea that you could hit very precise targets because you're relying upon information networks in space and elsewhere to guide these weapons to their target, hypersonic as well, these both very quick and maneuverable weapons. And so you are seeing some of these new technologies being kind of shared, or what we call entangled, with existing support structures for nuclear weapons. Like, nuclear weapons often rely upon space capabilities, so satellites for communications, for guidance to their targets, to see what they destroy if they're used. So space is a really important for early warning of a nuclear attack. So there's lots of ways in which nuclear weapons are entangled with space. And then there's this, of course, ongoing question of whether or not artificial intelligence capabilities do enter into the kind of decision-making, I guess, structures or capabilities for, you know, when you think about using nuclear weapons as well. So all of these things muddy, if you like, the threshold of nuclear weapons use. And then it gets hard to know when you're actually crossing the nuclear threshold and breaking the nuclear taboo. So, for example, if one country uses conventional weapons to attack an adversary's nuclear weapons, is that crossing or breaking the nuclear taboo?
Exactly.
Or is the nuclear taboo only broken if that country retaliates for that attack with nuclear weapons? So that's the kind of fuzziness that you get with these new technologies. So depends very much on how countries, I think, choose to exploit or restrain themselves when it comes to using these technologies in ways that fuzzy or sort of disrupt the clarity of the nuclear threshold that enables us to know when we're going to break the nuclear taboo or not.
Yeah.
So that's my answer. And in some ways, it's a somewhat optimistic one, because it means that you don't have technology development blindly pushing us towards a world in which we're going to end up in a nuclear war. It's in the hands of decision makers and militaries how they use these capabilities, whether they take those dangers off the table or whether they choose to exploit them.
Yeah, I think that's very helpful. Thank you so much. So let's move our discussion from technology and the nuclear issue a little bit to China-US.
Yes.
So in recent years, the United States has tightened the technological restriction on China in area like artificial intelligence, quantum computing, all this kind of thing. So of course, China also tried to make some breakthrough in areas like AI.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think this kind of technological rivalry between China and the United States will increase the risk of the nuclear risk or leads to kind of misjudgment and also bring more tension between the two countries?
Mm-hmm. So I think there are a lot of factors and some of them kind of go around in a circle. Because my understanding is that at least some of the technology sanctions that the United States has put on China because it is concerned about the military applications of some of these technologies, they are sometimes general purpose technologies that can do everything from help you to run through medical diagnostic results quickly and more efficiently to see if there's abnormalities. But, you know, sometimes you're using similar kinds of capabilities for enhancing weapons capabilities. So it's that kind of dual use issue that I think led to motivations from the US to try and put these sanctions on China and to take that cost, if you like, of knowing that it also has an impact on civilian parts of the economies of the two countries. My understanding, though, is that those technology sanctions have been a negative signal of US intentions for China. Yeah. And so that ends up driving more of the political risk in the relationship and leading to more erosion of the foundations, I think, of past US-China relations, where the ideas of military conflict and difficulties and crises in the relationship has sat alongside what was a relatively mutually beneficial economic relationship. We see a lot more, I think, of the competitive and adversarial aspects of the relationship now extending into the technological and into the economic realms of the relationship. And so that means you have less ballast, if you like, in the relationship to try and keep you out of a crisis or a conflict, and more mistrust, if you like, about what one another's intentions towards the other.
So in the nuclear relations, do you think China-US now have more tensions than, let's say, comparing with 10 years ago?
Definitely. So. Yes. And I mean, my understanding is that also one of the reasons why China made a decision to modernize its nuclear arsenal a little bit quickly is related to
the more competitive relationship to this
sense that China feels pressure and feels insecurity from the United States. And I think opinions will differ in China as to how directly or how detailed the calculation then becomes about what kind of nuclear capabilities you need. Is this a really detailed calculation about survivability and exchange rates of nuclear warheads and this kind of thing? Or is it more of a psychological thing that when you have that kind of very strong backing, then you can feel a little bit more comfortable for facing a more confrontational relationship? So it's more of a psychological as opposed to a kind of military calculation. Of course, though, that modernization generated a lot of concern in the United States because I think a lot of US decision makers and scholars don't have a good understanding of why China has made this decision. Yeah. The Chinese government has not said a whole lot about it at all. And so then the nuclear reaction to a more tense political relationship drives more tension and mistrust about the other side's intentions. And so we'll wait to see what the US does, but you can see how you end up really entrenching this security dilemma between the two countries.
So are we stepping into kind of arms race?
I am concerned. I mean, you can look at the situation and say that there are still opportunities for the two countries to try and put the brakes on an arms race. But I think the earlier you do that, the easier it becomes, because it takes time to build up support for certain kinds of reactions or steps. And I see in the United States a consensus or a constituency forming for the idea that when US-Russia arms control, the last treaty is going to expire in 2026, limiting the US's deployed nuclear weapons. And at that stage, the US might need to think about deploying more nuclear warheads because of what it perceives as the challenge posed by the growth of China's arsenal. It's going to need more warheads deployed so that it can carry out nuclear operations in the manner that it deems as necessary.
Yes. So then now with President Trump in the White House, I think he brings in many new ideas, new proposals, new initiatives, and he is someone who believe he is very good at making deals. So with the second Trump administration, do you think China and the U.S. have kind of possibility to reach some kind of deal or agreement over this strategic stability issue, nuclear issue, or will we see more tension, more friction between the two countries? What's the future?
So I think both sides have learned from the first Trump administration and the 4 years of the Biden administration in between. And I think the short answer is it's too early to say whether or not there will be an agreement. And even the day before an agreement, it may still be too early to tell, because I think one of the Trump administration's characteristics is that it can be a little bit more unpredictable. Mm-hmm. You don't know whether you're going to get a deal or a problem the night before you end up in the meeting room. But that said, I think it's really going to depend upon the decision makers in the United States and China making a deal a high priority.
Yeah.
And I don't think that managing nuclear risks, especially between the United States and China, has been the top priority or even close to the top priority for Chinese and U.S.
But
leaders.
President Trump said he does not want to fight a war. He wants peace.
Yes, and he also mentioned that he wanted to have a kind of trilateral arms deal with Russia and with China. But at the same time, one of the first things his administration did was to issue an executive order calling for a more extensive missile defense
program.
The Iron Dome, Iron Dome for America. And this is picking up on one of China's most serious concerns about U.S. capabilities. China has been worried about U.S. missile defense literally for decades.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, you have let's make a deal. And on the other hand, you have really putting the pedals to the floor, going full speed on a capability that generates a lot of anxiety among China's nuclear decision makers. So I think it's possible that the two countries could come up with some ways to better manage their nuclear risks, but it is going to require a very high level of priority from the two leaders. And they have so much on their plate.
Yes.
They have so many other issues to solve. They have the rest of the world's nuclear issues also to think about. There's the Ukraine conflict resolution. You have the North Korean nuclear issue. You have the Iran nuclear issue. So there are lots of things going on in the nuclear arena that the two countries could work on if they, among themselves, for their own relationship, find some difficulties. And I'd also note that I think the United States and China have had some very fruitful areas of cooperation in nuclear security as well. So securing nuclear materials so they don't fall into the hands of rogue actors.
Mm-hmm.
That's been a quiet but very successful area of nuclear cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
So even if the two countries maybe have difficulty coming up with ways to stabilize their own pursuit of more nuclear arms or some of these incentives to use nuclear weapons or these risks related to new technology, there are actually a whole lot of other nuclear issues they can cooperate on as two influential powers who have a lot of, I think, influence and respect for different reasons in things like the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty review process, which is now ongoing.
Yeah.
So of the big deal over this issue, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But if there is a big deal in U.S.-China relations, maybe one good last line to add in there is at least to start talking about how the U.S. and China can define their nuclear relationship. Because I think if there's one thing that's clear, it's that the U.S.-Soviet model for managing a great power nuclear relationship is not one that China welcomes structuring its own relationship with the United States.
Mm-hmm.
There needs to be something tailor-made for the U.S.-China relationship.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think Even if probably we won't have a deal over nuclear issue, or at least before any nuclear deal, there are plenty of things that we can do together to try to lower the risks, to decrease the tension. I think that's very important. And also, I think, of course, learning from history is always important. But, I mean, China-US relations is very much different from Soviet-US relations. And also, I think technology is also one thing. You know, technology is very different today comparing with 40, 50 years ago. So at least from Chinese perspective, we cannot just simply use this historic experience to copy it to today's China-US nuclear relations. Yeah, thank you very much, Fiona. So this is a very serious but very interesting discussion. I think probably the most serious and the most important podcast discussion I have ever had. Yeah, but I hope our audience will enjoy this discussion. I believe they will. Thank you very much. And also hope you can spend the rest of your time, I think two more days
in China. Just one more day.
Okay. Hope your trip to China can have a very perfect concluding tomorrow. Yes.
Well, this is a wonderful way to start to bring it to a conclusion. And I will say that while nuclear weapons is a very heavy topic, it is so heavy that it paradoxically generates these pressures or these interests in cooperation. So it has both of these elements, which is one of the reasons why I enjoy working on this topic. But thank you so much for having me. It's really been a pleasure chatting about this issue, and I hope I can come back soon.
Yeah, thank you for coming.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
This was Dr. Fiona Cunningham unraveling the intricate interplay between innovation and international security. Despite the technological competition between China and the United States, there is still room for cooperation in nuclear risk management and reduction. For more cutting-edge discussion, stay tuned to the Point series. Until next time.